Yes, we are. And we caught us right in the middle of a conversation between Polarity One, Polar Levine, and myself, your news dissector, Danny Schechter, here in the studio. And we are attempting today to build a bridge to Tehran, Iran, to speak to a person there, a professor, who hopefully can give us some information about what's actually happening in Iran today.
We're building that bridge. You know?
Yeah, I don't think it's just engineering skills, personally, but let's see what we can do now. So we're going to begin the program with some music that Polar selected, some Iranian music, hopefully, and we're going to move from that into our discussion. Here we go.
از دست و دل شده هستم دستی بری دلم نه دستی بری دلم نه ای پاک از آب و از گل ای پاک از از دست و دل از دست و دل شده استم دستی بری دلم نه دستی بری دلم نه.
Well, what do you know? The wonders of technology come through again. And here we are on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector here. And we wanted to talk a little bit about one of the most interesting developments perhaps in the world, and a country that's not very well understood by the United States. We've just come through a campaign over months with the Israelis particularly, and many conservatives, so-called conservatives in America, insisting that Iran was building nuclear weapons and that Iran was threatening us. Now we've had the new president of Iran said, no, he would never build a nuclear weapon. I actually spoke with the former president of Iran and asked him about it. He said, No, we're not building any weapons. But no matter what he said, if he said they weren't, that was evidence somehow that they were. So, Mr. Azadi, are you there?
No, he's not there yet.
Not there yet. Hopefully we'll get through to him. This is a difficult communication process. I don't know. Sometimes it's more difficult inside the studio than it is between the studio and the rest of the world. At any rate, I mean, what's happening that's very interesting, of course, is that Iran has had elections, presidential elections. Mr. Rouhani is the new president, who's considered a moderate. And with us now from Tehran, Iran, Mr. Azadi, how are you?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm so happy that we made this happen. It's not that easy, but we're pleased. I'm in the studio in New York, and you are in Tehran, Iran. You're a professor there. Tell us a little bit about your background and that you also studied here in America.
Yes, I teach at the University of Tehran Faculty of World Studies, and I did get my PhD from Louisiana State University in Mass Communication.
Well, any graduate of Louisiana State University is someone I have to defer to on this subject. But tell me, you know, we're obviously, we've been psyched up with war fever here in America. President announced he was going to bomb Syria. And then he announced he was going to consult with the Congress. Then the Congress basically, you know, refused to support it. So he withdrew the idea. Then Putin came along and said, that Syria was prepared to destroy its weapons, and Syria says it's prepared to do that, although it'll take a year and cost $1 billion. We've been in, you know, a wild back and forth situation here, totally unpredictable, and it has many Americans confused. And of course, the so-called serious experts here, and I put that in quotes, experts, you know, are saying, well, all of this is really not important, Syria's not important, because the real danger is Iran. And now we have the president saying, well, he might meet with the Iranian president, and that there's been some communication back and forth between Tehran and Washington. So help us understand, if you will, understand more clearly what's happening in Iran, and is there a thaw, a breakthrough, a change in policy? How do you see it?
Well, this particular government in Tehran, the new administration of President Rouhani, does want to improve relations with the countries that historically have been at odds with Iran's government. Plus, we are facing major sanctions, economic sanctions against Iran, and these sanctions are designed to hurt ordinary citizens, with the hope of hurting them enough so they can get tired of the situation and then rise up and have a revolution and overthrow the government. That's the idea behind the sanctions.
And it hasn't happened, has it?
It hasn't happened, and I don't think it will happen, because people of Iran, like other people, remember history. They know that the United States had a coup d'etat here in 1953, overthrew democratically elected government, and since that time has been engaging in activities that actually in reality have been hurting people. They supported the Shah government that was a brutal dictator. They actually established this secret police service called the SAVAK, the intelligence service that was focused on dissidents in Iran. And when people got tired of all that and wanted to have a more independent country, a more independent government, and had a revolution, then the U.S. government, unfortunately, first of all, stayed and supported the Shah until the last minute, and then instead of sort of changing course and changing its policy toward Iran, they did not want to do that, and they actually, for example, supported Saddam Hussein during his war with Iran, giving him aid, satellite intelligence, which nowadays you hear even in mainstream news media in the United States, that Saddam's government used that satellite images to attack Iranian forces with chemical weapons.
Yeah, let's not let that slip. This whole notion that actually the United States armed Saddam Hussein with chemical weapons, and the chemical weapons we used, some of them apparently against people in Iraq, but also against the people of Iran. And when I was in Iran, I met someone who had, a member of the parliament, who had been gassed in that war and experienced it personally. And I'm sure you know people who have.
Yes, people of our age have been affected. People who live in the border area have been affected. And as you said, Saddam gassed the Kurdish population in the northern part of Iraq. So given that history, ordinary Iranian citizens who may not actually like the current government also oppose the U.S. policies toward Iran because of this 60 years of what I heard a few days ago Noam Chomsky called torture of Iranian people. And I think Noam Chomsky is right. The U.S. government has been torturing Iranian people for the last 60 years or so. And because of that history, there is more or less a general consensus that whatever the U.S. says and its actual deeds are quite different. Given all that history, the new administration wants to do things that will stop these type of illegal sanctions that the U.S. government has against Iranian people. And you know, nowadays when you go to pharmacies in Iran, there's some medicine that is not available, the medicine that's imported because of U.S. sanctions. There are parts for factories, just civilian factories that are not available because of sanctions. So people are hurting. And the new administration wants to do things to basically get these sanctions removed, and so that explains this exchange of letters, and with Dr. Rouhani coming to New York next week for the UN General Assembly, I think he's going to try to see if he can take actions to go forward with sort of resolving these issues. The only problem that we have is that you know, we have the Israeli lobby that does not like these sanctions removed. They generally support laws in the U.S. Congress that put these sanctions in place. They don't want to sort of get rid of the sanctions. Unfortunately, we have in Israel the Netanyahu administration that actually likes to see a war between U.S. and Iran. They don't want to attack Iran directly. They fear the consequences, so they want the U.S. soldiers to do the job for them. And
let me just take a breath here with you, because I think you're making a number of points that I'm not sure Americans really understand and appreciate fully. Namely, that the sanctions imposed on Iran, supposedly to stop Iran's nuclear program, are actually having the biggest impact not on the government of Iran as much as on the people of Iran. And that's affecting food, it's affecting medicines, it's affecting life in Iran. So it's not, this is not something that's just sort of a targeted weapon aimed at a government that we don't like. It's actually impacting the people of Iran and, in a way, encouraging them to be more angry at the United States. True?
The idea behind the sanctions is that they want the Iranian people to be against their own government. But as I said, Iranian people have been living with this history of U.S. policies that are hurting them even before the current revolution. You know, during the Shah's time, U.S. policies were hurting Iranian people. After the overthrow of the Shah, U.S. policies have been hurting the people. So in reality, instead of the people being angry at their own government, which was the idea behind the sanctions, they are actually angry against the U.S. government for imposing these sanctions. So they are, the U.S. policymakers are not achieving their goal, and they are basically doing things that is not really in line, I think, with U.S. foreign policy interests. The current government in Iran, even the previous governments, have been trying to reduce tensions with the U.S. government, but in reality, we see the U.S. government wants to use this issue of nuclear program to pressure Iran more. I would suggest your listeners to read the transcripts of James Clapper's testimony at the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee. He was there in March, a month ago.
This is the national security guy, right?
Right. He's DNI, the Director of National Intelligence.
Yeah.
James Clapper, Director of National Intelligence. You know, that's the office that was created after 9/11. He is the head of all the intelligence community, the 16 intelligence communities that the U.S. has. So he's overseas CIA, FBI, other intelligence communities. That testimony is quite interesting because in that testimony, he says that we are not sure if the Iranian government has decided to make a nuclear bomb. So what he's saying is that not only Iran does not have a nuclear weapon, he says that the decision to make one has not been made. And so people in Iran, you know, see this in the news items. I don't know if your listeners or people who are in the States have heard this. We can go and read the full transcripts in at the
it's quite fascinating. The other day I saw a report, and I didn't see it anywhere else, just in the Los Angeles Times, a report that disclosed that Israel has 80 nuclear bombs. This wasn't picked up almost by any media. It certainly wasn't perceived as anything that would be threatening to anyone. And Israel, of course, has a policy of not disclosing information about its nuclear program. But I'm sure that folks in your country saw that report.
Yes. Yes, they did. And let me also say this. Whenever, occasionally, or more than occasionally, we criticize Netanyahu's administration or something that the Israeli government does, this doesn't mean that you're anti-Semitic. This doesn't mean we don't like Jews. Actually, when I was in the States, many of my closest friends were Jews. They were, they happen also to be socialists, which is another story. But Jews are, like other people of faith, are peaceful, sort of friendly. We don't need to, nice people, like others.
The very fact that you feel the need to say that, and even though I'm sure that it's raising eyebrows with people who are here, including in the studio, because the idea of Jews are my best friends kind of thing sounds patronizing, but the fact that we've had so little communication and cooperation, and people here don't know that the Jewish community, there was a big Jewish community in Tehran,
Well, there's a large Jewish Iranian community in America.
All of these issues have been affected, let's say infected, with the propaganda virus, which is, U.S. good, Iran bad, basically. And that's why I was curious about, here you are, you're a professor in Iran, but you went to university in Louisiana. Okay, in the deep south in America, LSU, and you were exposed to, not only traditional American culture, but redneck culture as well south. And what was that like for you to go there and then to go back to Iran?
Well, it was quite a culture shock, to say the least. The point I was trying to make was criticizing Israel does not mean someone is anti-Semitic. Israeli government, like any other government, sometimes makes right policies, sometimes makes wrong policies. And just because you criticize the wrong policies doesn't mean you don't like Jews or you don't like people of that faith. So that is something that the problem, as you know, is that whenever especially people from our part of the world criticize these mistakes that I think the Israeli government is making, then we are labeled as anti-Semites, and we are said that we want to throw Jews to the, to the sea and things of this nature, sort of trying to demonize us as people of violence. And I'm sure, violence exists in this part of the world same way.
Understand that when Jewish Americans are critical of Israel, we're called self-hating Jews, okay? This is a way in which powerful interests want people to think in black and white terms and not to really understand the historical perspective, the background, or any kind of cultural framework about all of this. Now, tell us about most Americans do know about your former president, who was talk about demonization. He not only was demonized, but he seemed to love it. It kind of cultivated, attacks on himself. Now, what has changed in Iran? What do you think is happening among Iranian people? The election of Rouhani, what is its significance?
Iran, like many other countries, has different political parties, and they are different in the philosophy and in terms of foreign relations that they propose. So Ahmadinejad belonged to the camp that said that you have to stand up to Western powers, and he was saying that this nuclear issue is just an excuse to hurt Iran more, and his rhetoric was quite strong. Rouhani, on the other hand, belongs to the camp that says that if we do a better job diplomatically, if we present our case more clearly, if we sort of accommodate the other side more easily, then things will get better. He's of this opinion. He belongs to the camp that is of this opinion. And now the Iranian people sometimes vote for the first camp and sometimes vote for the second camp. You know,
where does Khamenei stand on this?
Let's just explain this to, and perhaps have you explain this to our listeners. Iran has a supreme ruler, structure where a person who is really coming from a religious background, as I understand it, is the arbiter of political decisions and is overseeing, oversight, like our Supreme Court. Your supreme ruler is sort of the man at the top. But he seems to be working with, or willing to work with, sort of so-called hardliners and more diplomatically oriented people. So explain to us, what is a supreme ruler and what does he do?
Well, he is a person, as you said, of religious background, by a parliament that the members of this parliament are elected by the people. So he's indirectly elected by the people. Unlike the president, in Iran, the president is directly elected, and we don't have this system of electoral college, so it's direct people vote that elects the president. And the leaders can end at any time. So he basically serves with the approval of that parliament that elects him, and that parliament can dismiss him the same way that they elected him. Going back to the first, the previous point, when Khatami was president of Iran, and he was a more moderate voice, as you remember, and you know, based on what U.S. government officials, people like James Dobbins, who became the first U.S. ambassador after the Taliban in Afghanistan, have said this in public on the record, Iran actually helped the U.S. government to basically get rid of some Taliban elements that were giving Iran also a hard time. And after that help, what happened was that this was in October and November of 2001, and President Bush in January of 2002, in his State of Union address, called Iran a member of Axis of Evil. And this was a shock to a lot of people in Iran, because after the help that Khatami gave to the other side, after basically said, you know, he said nice things about the U.S. presidents. He called Lincoln a martyr in an interview with CNN, and you know, different gestures that he had at that time. Instead of getting a positive response from the Bush administration, he basically got a slap in the face, and his country was listed as a member of Axis of Evil. And it was this type of negative response from the U.S. government that led to the election of Ahmadinejad. Ahmadinejad came to power saying that Khatami was too soft, too weak, and he came and changed this policy of talking nicely to big powers. And then, obviously, he did not get very far with that policy. And the Iranian electorate now has again chosen a more moderate president. And people are basically waiting to see what will happen when Dr. Rouhani comes to New York next week. Is he going to be treated the same way that Khatami was, or is the U.S. government is going to change its policies? I think this is a good time for both sides to re-examine their policies towards each other, and then see if they can find a way to go away from this line of confrontation. Because as we have seen in Syria, when two countries are sort of having this high rhetoric against each other, then it may lead to war. And you know, we just were witnessing another war, which was diverted with what happened in the last couple of weeks.
Does the supreme leader Khomeini support Rouhani's overtures to the United States? Because Khomeini, the supreme leader, who we understand in America, decides who can and cannot run for president. Where does he stand on the issue of easing relations with the United States?
First of all, he is not the person who decides who becomes president.
No, he doesn't decide who becomes, but he decides who can and cannot run for president.
He doesn't. There is a body that administers elections in Iran, and it's that body that decides who is going to be eligible. And there are rules and regulations. And so this year we had 8 major candidates that were eligible to run. And Rouhani was the only cleric out of the 8. The other 7 were not clerics. But Rouhani managed to win. And he was actually the most moderate voice within that many people. There was another person, you know, Khatami's vice president was also running, but he quit. He got out of the race under the request of Khatami, because Khatami wanted to get all the reformers voters behind Rouhani, and that's how Rouhani became president. On the issue of relations with the U.S., Ayatollah Khamenei had an, I think, important speech yesterday talking about compromise, talking about being flexible to the other side. And he's basically sending a signal to the U.S. government that with this trip that Rouhani is making, he has all the authority to make a deal if the other side is available for that. Because if, I don't know how closely you follow Iranian politics and the issues that deal with Iran-U.S. relations, we have some segment of the experts, as you call them in quotes, in the United States that say the president of Iran has, you know, is just, he doesn't have any powers.
Figurehead.
It's the leader that decides everything. It doesn't matter who becomes president in Iran. You have a segment of the so-called experts that sort of say these things. In reality, that's not true. As you see, when Rouhani became president, he first of all took the portfolio, the Iran's nuclear program portfolio, he took it away from the Iranian National Security Council and gave it to the Foreign Ministry, which is a place that, you know, deals are made easier. He appointed a person who was a graduate of University of Denver, Dr. Javad Zarif. He got his PhD from University of Denver, U.S. educated, is considered to be someone who is available to make compromise with the other side. So he has done these things, and I think the Iranian government, whether it's the president or the leader or other players in Iran, are very much available for a compromise, and they see, they're sending this signal, and they see the ball to be in U.S. court. They're sort of hoping that the Obama administration will change course. And what they are saying is that they have been saying this for even during Ahmadinejad's time. The Iranian government has been saying that if you are suspicious of our nuclear program, why don't you join it by saying that you come as a country and basically oversee what you are doing. Iran has been allowing UN inspectors to come into the country. They are monitoring Iran's nuclear 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They are filming major Iranian facilities, and they come and go all the time. We have, you know, at any time, we have 3, 4, 5 UN inspectors in Iran monitoring Iran's nuclear activities. And Iran is going beyond that. Iran is saying that, why not have American companies come into Iran and do joint venture with Iranian companies? And when they're doing joint ventures, they are going to see what's going on. They're going to have people on the ground.
Mr. Sadi, this is very fascinating. It's obviously information that our listeners and most Americans don't have. They don't really have a perspective on this. Can I invite you to stay with us on the program? We have to take a short break, and I'd like to continue this conversation with you from Tehran, Iran. It's quite fascinating for us, and I really appreciate your coming on. Can you stay with us for a while?
Yes, it's about 2 a.m. here, but I'll be with you. I'll sleep a little late.
Okay.
Morning.
We're just going to go for another 20 minutes or so, okay? So we're going to take our break. Now, we had a little music, some Iranian music that we'll play for you just to keep the mood going here, and we'll take our break, and then we'll be back. And where else would we be talking directly to Tehran, Iran, on the radio? It's 2 o'clock in the morning there. Our guest, Mr. Azadi, has agreed to stay with us for a few more minutes to continue this conversation. It's quite fascinating because he's giving us a whole different perspective on what we're getting in the media here. Of course, we have quite a large group, shall we say, of pundits and so-called experts in this country who don't want any peaceful resolution. In fact, they want a war with Iran. Not that they've really thought about what it would mean or what would happen as a result of it. Nevertheless, they are, seem to be bent on more conflict and more confrontation. I don't know if it's the Israel lobby. I don't know if it's just their typical reaction. I mean, we've saw in this situation with Syria, 90% of the American people didn't want a war, and I would say 95% of the TV pundits did want a war, and they were arguing for it from the various think tanks in Washington. So we have this disconnect here between the people who are supposed to know the most and the American people who don't really like what they're saying, by and large. Did you find that to be true? In your experience, in the academic world in the United States?
Can you repeat the question? I lost your voice for a second.
Okay, I'm sorry. I was saying that there's been a gap here between the so-called experts, the pundits on television, who are much more bellicose, much more interested in promoting war than the people, both of the right and the left, who are against war. And the public opinion was totally against bombing Syria, but the television experts, so-called, seem to be, taking a hard line, the same way that they do with Iran, despite, we say we let the facts don't seem to matter to them.
Yes, it's true that many, at least, experts in the United States are not presenting a clear picture on Iranian issue. And the reason is that many of these experts belong to think tanks that are funded by big corporations, and big corporations, 1% in the United States generally benefits from wars, and we have difficulties in that area. But there are some people who are doing a better job. I would suggest your readers to read this book by Flint and Hilary Leveres. It's called Going to Tehran. It was published a few months ago. The title is Going to Tehran. And there is actually a website with the same name that they have. Flint Leveres used to work for the CIA for many years. He went to become a member of National Security, U.S. National Security Council, as an expert, and his wife Hillary worked for the State Department, and his wife actually happens to be also Jewish, and she has spent many years at the State Department. They have written this book, which presents the current situation between Iran and the United States, and I think they are among few people who have actually gotten the story right. There are other places that are doing a relatively better job. Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, they have an expert, Iran expert, Phyllis Berens, who has been writing interesting and sort of good articles on the situation. We have other institutions. There's another place called Just Foreign Policy that is doing a good job. So I think for your listeners, I'm not saying that listen to me and then accept what I'm saying. I think what you're saying is that instead of just listening to what NBC, ABC, CBS is saying about Iran, why not listen to alternative media? Why not read some books that challenge the main discourse on Iran? And then I think if they do that, they will become more educated citizens, and these issues and public opinion in the U.S. matters. You see what happened in Syria. Majority of Americans were against the war, and that public opinion affected Obama's decision. I think if the public opinion was not so much against the war, I think he probably would have launched another war in the Middle East attacking Syria. So I think for U.S. citizens to be educated about what's going on here is important. And unfortunately, the U.S. government seems to be very much in line of wanting to interfere in different countries here. And it's maybe a responsibility of American citizens to find out what the government is doing and then criticize it if they realize that the policy that the government is taking is not correct.
Well, as you know, I went to Iran myself and have met with people there, and I came away feeling, you know, that there's a whole side of the story, maybe the real story, that Americans are not getting. Of course, we're not only getting this sort of propaganda coming from media, but also movies like Argo, in a way, reinforce this notion of, you know, this anti-American fanaticism in Iran. And without any stripped of context, stripped of background, stripped of any basic understanding. And I think conversations like the one we're having now, however large the audience is, are important to have this kind of dialogue and you know, real conversation between people who are not just pushing a line, but trying to find out what is actually going on. And, you know, the idea that Iran is, you know, being described in our media certainly over and over again as, you know, kind of bent on dominating the entire Middle East. And what we're finding is the reaction of Iranian political leaders is quite different and has been quite different.
Right. And if you look at, for example, Iran's military budget, it's one of the lowest in terms of as a percentage of Iran's gross national product. Iran, as you know, went through 8 years of war with Iraq, and you see during that period, although Iraq attacked Iran using chemical weapons, and Iran had chemical weapons in its arsenal dating back to the Shah's time, but Iran never attacked the other side with chemical weapons. So we are obviously not saying that the Iranian government is perfect or without faults, but in history, in recent history, you have seen that Iran has been, Iranian government has been responsible when it had the chance and a choice of doing bad things like other people in this neighborhood. And I think that's something that should be taken into account. And I'm glad we have people like James Clapper, the Director of National Intelligence in the United States, that are actually saying things that if people actually pay attention to, realize that the rhetoric that they get in the U.S. media is even much farther than what the U.S. government officials are saying in these hearings and in congressional settings. The fact that James Clapper says that Iran has not decided to make a nuclear weapon, that decision has not been made. And the second thing he says is that if Iranian leaders decide to make a nuclear weapon, they'll find out about it and they'll be able to stop it, then this type of information is not even available in the mainstream media in the United States. So it seems that the media in the States is interested in a certain discourse with regard to Iran that generally demonizes Iran. And for, as I said, American public to become, to reach a more proper conclusion, they need to diversify their sources of information.
Well, there certainly is, you know, interest in Iran. In the United States, there's a big exhibit going on at the Asia Society here in New York of art from Iran. There's a, you know, interest in the music of Iran as well. So it's not as if there's no interest at all. I think there is interest. The problem is that the way our media is set up, it's sort of set up as structured, sort of phony debates between Republicans and Democrats who tend to agree with each other more than disagree with each other. And there's very little time to actually examine background, to examine the context, to look at what causes problems and what have you. So when you ask Americans about our own government, you'll find a pathetic level of ignorance about how our system works, much less the system of any other country. And this is something that, of course, I'm concerned about. Many of us are. And that's one of the reasons we're doing this program. I write my newsdissector.net blog every day to try to talk about not just what's in the news, but what's missing from the news. Because a lot of times it's not just censorship per se, it's selection, what you cover and what you don't cover. And I know that you've spent some time examining the American media and the world media system as well as the Iranian media. Do you agree with this perspective, or am I missing something?
No. In mass communication literature, in academic literature, there's this theory of agenda setting that I think you're familiar with. Agenda setting says that the media does not tell people what to think about, the media tells people what to think about. So they set a number of stories.
Not what to think about. Yeah, okay.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So they set a number of stories and they tell people that these are the important things that you have to pay attention to. And there might be tens of other important stories that are in reality censored. Not obviously if people go and look for it and spend a lot of time, they may be able to find the stories about them, but they're censored in the sense that they're not easily available. They're not highlighted when people watch the news, you know, the evening news in the States. Because of this situation, and on the other hand, we see that the media, they do have, they're subjective in terms of wanting to present a discourse on certain issues. They are doing a better job many times on domestic issues. They tend to be more objective when it comes to domestic
issues. What about your students? You're at a university in Iran. What, in terms of critical ideas and thinking and debating issues, are you finding students interested in doing that?
Yes. You know, the interesting thing is that the students here are exposed not only to the Iranian media, they're also exposed to Western media, they're exposed to a lot of news sites, and they tend to read. A lot of our students tend to diversify their sources of information, and they're trying to sort of find out why their country is under so much pressure, why Iran is under so many sanctions, why they cannot do things that other people at their age are doing in other parts of the world. And when they look at these issues, they generally reach the same conclusion that their parents reached a generation ago, which they realize that they live in a country that is rich in oil. They realize that there are other countries, powerful countries, that need this oil, and they realize that these powerful countries will do whatever needs to be done to make sure that a source of energy is available for them at a cheap price. And when they realize that, then they become upset because they tend to think that the oil that is in Iran belongs to the Iranian people and should, they should be able to sell it at a fair price. And that is what we see when the students come to our classes. They are generally wondering why the world is working the way it's working. And then as they progress, they realize what is really happening in the world. And that is why having this type of aggressive policy towards Iran is not going to work, because the old generation does not like these policies. The new generation is realizing what's going on and does not like this policy. And I'm sure if the policies don't change, the next generation will not also like policies. I think it's about time for these policies to be reexamined. And I think people in the United States may have this duty of sort of finding out what's right, and then they need to tell their elected officials to basically do what is right. And this is what they did with regard to Syrian war. And what is happening with Iran is kind of war in itself. Sanctioning a country is a type of war. In fact, threatening to attack a country is against the UN Charter. The first article of the UN Charter prohibits not only the use of force against another country, the threat of force against another country is also illegal under international law. And every other day you see an American official threatening Iran militarily, saying all the options are on the table. And these are basically illegal under international law. And so.
Yeah, but we would never know that here in the United States, because no one points it out to us. We have to call someone like yourself in Iran to find out about international law and to find out what's actually going on there. And I wanted to thank you so much. I promised that I'd let you get back to sleep. It's 2:30, almost 2:30 in the morning in Tehran, yeah. Iran. But this is a really valuable conversation for me. You've been over this ground a lot before, but I'm not sure our listeners here on Progressive Radio Network have heard someone from Iran. We want to thank Reza Matazami for helping to organize this conversation. And I hope we can have you on again to continue to talk about these problems, because clearly there needs to be some channel of back and forth discussion. Polar, agree?
Yes. Yes, I do.
Okay, well, my colleague agrees, and we agree, and now you can go to sleep. Thank you very much. Okay.
Good. Take care. So long.
Okay. So that's a conversation coming to you. I don't know if is your mic not working? There's a problem here with his mic. I'm not sure why. But, you know, we had hoped to do another segment, but that was really quite interesting, and I think we have to be willing to have this reaching out across the world. Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, you know, is a platform for doing that. And I saw this opportunity, especially now because Iran is in the news. The president of Iran is coming, perhaps to New York. There's been talk of conversations between President Obama, President Rouhani of Iran. So it was interesting to have this sort of background with us. We want to switch ground here a little bit and go not to Iran but to Greece, because in Greece last night or the other night, a 34-year-old anti-fascist and left-wing rapper, Pavios Fissas, known as Killer P, was stabbed to death when he was surrounded by a group of 30 thugs in Golden Dawn shirts. Golden Dawn is this fascist party that has emerged in Greece. And the victim, whose stage name is MC Killapi, had been watching a soccer match with his girlfriend when he was murdered. This is an outrage. It's an outrage in Greece itself, because the police there apparently have raided the headquarters of this Golden Dawn organization. But we wanted to honor Killapi tonight and play one of his songs that's on YouTube and to give you a sense of this. And then I'll tell you a little bit. It's in Greek, and it's all Greek to me, but I'll tell you a little bit of what he's been saying. Killapi. R.I.P.
Looking out my window,
κοιτάζω πάλι απλό παράθυρο μου και αντικρίσω. Αυτό το γνώριμό μου, ναι, και οικείο γκρίζω. Βλέπω τα πουλιά να ταξιδεύουν πάλι μακριά. Από στα νερά μου που τα πούλησα, μικρό πολύ φθηνά. Βλέπω τον ήλιο χλωμό. Όπως χλωμά ήταν τα αστέρια που κοιτάζαμε μαζί τα σπρώμαυρά καλοκαίρια και τους. Ζωγραφιστούς χειμώνες, κρύες εικόνες μακούς. Κρατάω μια φωτογραφία σου στα χέρια. Κάθε αμάξι που περνάει, κάθομαι και το μετράω. Σα στιγμές από τη ζωή μου και θυμάμαι πως γερνάω. Μα δεν είναι εκεί κανείς για να μου κρατήσει. Το χέρι πίνω από την τελευταία μου πτήση. Σαν άγγελος που τον παράδεισο έχει παρατήσει. Γυρνάω πάλι πίσω στην παιδική μου φύση και κουρνιάζομαι κατά την κουβέρτα να κρυφθώ.
Killa P. Here's some of his words in English. A translation that was sent to me by a friend in Boston. The world has become a big prison, and I'm looking for a way to break the chains. There is a place waiting for me. They're at a high mountain peak for me. They're waiting for me to arrive. That's why I stretched again my two hands very high to steal some light from the bright stars. I cannot take it down here, and I'm about to choke from the human misery as much as sorrow. I cannot stand it anymore. And all those people were not from me, so I followed another path, and not the one they forced me to. It was rough, tough, and with many pitfalls. Bad love and friends like venomous vipers. It had monsters with strange uniforms, always secretly lurking in the shadows. Don't stop if you decide to follow it. Tighten your teeth firmly and do not cry. This is Killa P. Some of his words, some of his lyric. He was killed in Athens. His message to the fascists there were, fascists, one thing is certain. We do not forget. We do not forgive. You better start running now. And some of them are running now. So this is a, you know, a story that I haven't seen a lot of pickup here in the United States, but it's something that touched me a great deal last night. A musician.
I think it would be good for American rappers to look at those lyrics and think a little bit about the inconsequential dribble that comes out of so much American rap, as though there's nothing important going on to state.
So let's honor Killa P and the people in Greece, who 10,000 people who have come out marching under his banner, so to speak, and let's not forget what happened to him, and let's try to be open to the music of the world and the culture of the world. Of course, just last week we commemorated the 40th anniversary of the coup in Chile, and there Victor Jara, the great musician, was murdered as well. So it's something that we should know about, we should care about. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector. You can read my blog at newsdissector.net and also our website, mediachannel.org, Pilar Levine's website.
PolarityOne.com, PolarityOne, and the number one.com. Lots of free music there for you.
So those are some resources. Thank you to PRN-FM for the News Dissector radio show. We'll be back again next week. Just next week, we already have booked next week, believe it or not.
Get out of here.
Yeah, and we have the author of the new book about WBCN, the great rock and roll station of all time, and also from Cambridge University in England, Narina Hertz is going to be here, a great economist and a brilliant thinker. So she'll be in the studio with us from England, and then we'll speak to Carter Allen in Boston. So be with us again next week, 5 o'clock, PRN.FM. Be there.
The world in a minute.
Morning, Sandy Station carries no news of the world.
Corporate America owns all the networks.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is identification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murdoch gets Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen, the camera, the sword, by a Coke, by a Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
Elvis Presley.
O.J. Simpson, abandoned baby.
Order now.
What we want, what we need, what we want, what we need. But do we even know who?